Well, we'll come again to Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. We looked this morning. We tried to look at least at verses 6 to 11, although we did go everywhere else as well. This evening, we'll look at chapter 2 and verses 12 to 16. So chapter 2 and verses 12 to 16. Lots of Americans are very proud of their country's First Amendment. So here in Wales, we might not be too familiar with what is meant by the First Amendment of the American Constitution. So I'll tell you what it is. It says this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So freedom of speech, freedom of worship. For many Americans, the First Amendment is important to their very identity. When I went to look what the First Amendment said, I did what any good researcher does. I typed it into Google, the First Amendment, and I came up with an essay written by an American high school student. And it's been a while since I've read a pupil's essay, so I enjoyed reading it because it reminded me of how some pupils say the same thing again and again. So they write one sentence and then they more or less say the same thing, it's just the words are in a slightly different order. And this is a bit like that. I'll read you a little bit of it. We enjoy privileges that people in some countries are not allowed. Criticizing the government, petitioning in the streets, or simply the idea of being able to speak your mind. It is important to me because I enjoy the First Amendment almost every second of my life. My life as an American would not be the same if I were not granted the simple freedoms of the First Amendment. These rights permit us to simple privileges that we use to conduct our daily lives. I wake up in the morning and read the paper. I listen to my music on the way to school. I am taught what my teacher chooses to teach. Major parts of our lives are spent doing things that would be limited if not for the First Amendment. You would not be able to express opinions or discuss things that could be seen controversial in any way. We would not have been able to write our blogs, criticizing the government. Life is unimaginable without the idea of being able to write, read, and say what we want. Now, in Wales, perhaps we're not so proud of our nation's laws, but there what comes across in that pupil's essay is a kind of pride. It's a badge of honor. This is part of my identity as an American. We have the First Amendment. Now, this morning we said chapter 2 seems to be addressed to Jewish people who were living in Rome who thought that what Paul had said in chapter 1 did not apply to them. And their thinking was this: but we are Jews and we possess the law. And so Paul deals with the fact that they've got the law in verses 17 to 24. And then they say we've also got circumcision. And he deals with that from verse 25 to the end of the chapter. We've got these things, and they show that we are God's special people. We are privileged people. How, therefore, can we come under the wrath of God? But this morning we said Paul addressed the individual. So we looked at verse 6. He will render to each one according to his works. And then in verse 11, that was important, for God shows no partiality. Whoever you are, whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Greek, whether you're part of the known world, part of Greek culture, there's no partiality. God will judge people according to the same standard, and the standard is what you have done. And so that theme continues now in verses 12 to 16. And it seems from verse 12 that Paul divides the whole world into two categories. So in verse 12, we read this. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. And all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. So there are two categories of people. There are those who have the law. There are those under the law. But there are also those who are without the law. Two kinds of people. The law there is referring to the law given to Moses on Mount Sinai, the law that was given to God's people as they were brought out of Egypt, and before they began their journey into the promised land, they were given the law of God. And so the Jews possessed the law, everyone else did not possess the law. Now, why did I give you that lengthy extract from the American Constitution, the First Amendment? I gave you that extract to make this point. Possession of the First Amendment came across, especially for that student who wrote that essay, it came across as a badge of honor. It contributed to that person's identity. Having it made them unique. Having it made them American. Now, it seems here that for the Jews, possession of the law was important for their very identity. It marked them out as special, unique people. It was their badge of honor. And it seems from what Paul is saying here is there was this general view that if you just possessed the law, if you knew the law, if you heard the law, then it would make you immune from God's wrath and his judgment. Now, Paul then has a word for two kinds of people. He has a different message for two categories. He has a message for those who possess the law, and he also has a message for those who had never heard of the law. Even if you're a Gentile, a Greek, and you might know there is a law of Moses, you might never have heard of it. You might know bits of it, you might know none of it. He had a message for them. And so these two categories of people, there is a message for both. For those who are under the law and those who are without the law. And so I want us to look at these two messages this evening. Firstly then, a word for those who possess the law. It's verse 13. Look at verse 13. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. So Paul is making maybe a rather obvious point. It is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God. That word righteous, here just think of it as meaning being right with God. It is not those who hear the law who are the ones who are right with God. Notice Paul uses the word hearers there. He is writing to Jewish people who would have gone to their synagogue and they would have heard the law being read by a scribe, being read by a rabbi. Hearing the law is one thing, but what matters is doing the law. Hearing the law won't make you right with God. And that word justified is there. It won't mean you're in a position where God will look at you and think of you as innocent. Hearing the law will not do that. What matters is doing the law. Now, remember this morning what we said about being hypothetical. Paul here again is being hypothetical. He is not saying there are some people who are doers of the law. Because we'll see at the end of this whole section, chapter 3 and verse 20, for by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. And chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned. So Paul is being hypothetical. He is not saying that there are doers of the law who have kept the law in such a way that they are right with God and they are declared to be innocent in his sight. That's not what he's saying. But what he is saying is this: hearing the law is not what matters. What matters is doing the law. And the sad reality is no one is a doer of the law. So if you are a hearer of the law, and you are proud of that, and you think the law is a wonderful thing, well, yes, it is a wonderful thing. Paul agrees with them in chapter 2 and verse 17, or rather verse 18, and know his will and approve what is excellent. He's saying the law is the will of God, and it is an excellent thing. Okay, that is true. But hearing the law and knowing the law does not make you right with God. Now, is that a word for you this evening? Back in 2001, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, you might make the mistake of thinking I'm American this evening, mightn't you? But the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court in 2001 erected a monument to the Ten Commandments. And I think he got in a bit of trouble at the time because he hadn't had all the permissions of the various people he needed. But you can Google it, and it was a granite monument of an open book, and there on the open book were written the Ten Commandments. He was saying to the state of Alabama, look at the mess we're in. Look at all the crime. What we need as a nation, or certainly what the state of Alabama needs, is to get back to the law of God, to get back to the Ten Commandments. And I think at the time there was some kind of national campaign where people wanted the Ten Commandments to be displayed on every classroom in the country, on the wall of every classroom. You might think, well, that might do some good here in Porth. If the local schools, if Porth County had the Ten Commandments written out on the wall of every classroom, it might remind pupils of the difference between right and wrong, and it might improve things in our community. Now, that's all very well, isn't it? And we might subscribe to that. And we should subscribe to that. There is a right sense in which we should tell people the law of God. It is a good law. Paul says it is excellent. In verse 18, it is a light to those who are in darkness. Of course it is. But knowing the law is not enough in itself. Knowing the law does not put you right with God. It might be that you pride yourself on your Christianity, what you consider your Christianity to be. I follow the Bible. The Bible is a good thing. This is a good ethic by which to live your life. It gives us a good moral code. Well, that's all very well. But grasp what Paul is saying here. It is not the hearers of the law. It is not even those who approve of the law who will be right with God. Approving of the law is not enough in itself. Now, at the beginning of this chapter, Paul said something very interesting. Go back to the beginning of chapter 2. He says this, therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same things. What Paul is saying there is this, you might have a particular moral code by which you live your life. And you might even say it's based on the law of God, it's based on the Ten Commandments. And therefore, when you see people breaking those commands, when you see someone who has stolen something, or you see someone who has committed adultery, and you judge that person according to the moral standards that you subscribe to, when you do that, you prove that you know what is right, and you know what is wrong. Do you understand what Paul is saying? When you judge people, you are proving to God that you know right from wrong. But by proving that you know right from wrong, it puts you in a dangerous situation. Because it means you justly come under God's judgment too. Because when you sin, you are guilty, and you know you are guilty. You know that you are without excuse because you've proved that you know right from wrong. from wrong. Now, all through the world, there are many people who subscribe to this kind of morality. But we need to grasp here that the law of God, it shows us our guilt. It shows us our sin. Now, we'll come on to that again. Secondly, there is a word here for those who don't possess the law. So Paul firstly addresses Jews who have the law, but then he also includes a word for those who have never even heard of the law of God or are unaware of the law that was given to Moses. So look at verses 14 and 15. He writes this, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law." Verse 15. "They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them." So remember that the big point is this: whether you have the law or whether you don't have the law, you're a sinner. Paul has made that clear in verse 12. "All who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law." So whether you have the law or whether you don't have the law, you're a sinner. And now he speaks to those who do not have the law. Verse 14, "When they by nature do what the law requires, and that they are a law to themselves." Now think of that last phrase for a moment. Don't misunderstand that last phrase. They are a law to themselves. I would sometimes speak about a particular class of children in that way in school. I've got 9N and it's Friday afternoon, period 5. And you know what they're like. They're a law to themselves. I would simply be talking in that way to say they ignore the rules. They're a badly behaved class. They do what they want. That's not the sense in which Paul is using the phrase here. It might be useful. The ESV is in the pulpit here, and that's what I'm using this evening. When you have the word "when" at the beginning of verse 14, it could be translated as "whenever." And it might be useful to use that as you read the verse. So whenever Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves. Paul is saying even when people who do not know the Ten Commandments or do not know the law that was given to Moses, whenever you see those people doing what the law requires, it proves they are a law to themselves. In other words, it proves they have a law within them. In other words, they might not have the law of Moses, but they do have a law within their hearts. A law is written upon their hearts. So whenever you see a person who has particular moral standards, that person might not be able to recite to you the Ten Commandments, but they have a law. They have certain standards within them. You see somebody whose conscience gets the better of them, and they pay their taxes. Or you see somebody, you see a couple who have been faithful to each other all of their lives, and they would have considered it a most terrible thing to have fallen into adultery, and they have done everything they can to keep themselves pure and faithful to each other. They are a law to themselves. They might not be able to recite the Ten Commandments, but they've proved that there is a law within them. And so Paul is saying that a law is within every human being. 3 centuries before Christ lived was Aristotle. And Aristotle distinguished between written law and general law. I won't read you everything of this little quote because it's a bit involved, but he said, "General law never changes. This law is not of now or yesterday, but is eternal." So Aristotle, who perhaps knew nothing of the Old Testament scriptures, or very little, he could identify a general law that was true for all men and women. A law where there was something eternal about it, that was written upon the hearts of all people. That God had put enough light within the heart of every man and woman to enable them to distinguish between right and wrong. Incidentally, we have something here called the moral argument for God. Where do our values come from? If you're in conversation with an atheist, it's a good conversation to have. Where does your sense of right and wrong come from? How do you account for the moral sense that you have within you? There's been things in the media over the last month or so about Martin Luther King. I think there must be some kind of anniversary. And we think about how society has changed. And you think about segregation in the United States and black people giving up their seats on buses and all of that kind of thing that took place. I think if I asked anybody to raise their hand this evening and to say, do you think racism is right? That it's okay to treat people badly because their skin is a different colour? I don't think any hand would be raised. Now, why is that the case? Nobody would say that in the 1950s racism was right and now it's become wrong. What we would probably all agree with this evening is that it was always wrong. It was always wrong and now things have been put right. And so we would agree there is a moral sense. There is an eternal law upon our hearts. Ravi Zacharias tells of a student who spoke to him after a lecture he'd given, and he argued that there was no such thing as objective good and evil. In other words, he was an atheist, and he said the rules we have in society are just things we have recognized as we've evolved that are there to help us get along with each other. But there's no such thing as objective right and wrong. We don't steal from each other because stealing means we don't get on with each other. And it's not good for societies to not get on with each other because as a species, we need to get on with each other in order to survive. And so it's convenient not to steal, but you wouldn't say it was objectively right or wrong. Well, Ravi Zacharias answered him and said this. I said, sir, I want to ask you a question. If I took a two-year-old child and put that child on this platform and took a sword and cut that child up ruthlessly to bits, would you think I had done something wrong? And he paused, and he said to me, I would not like it. I would not enjoy it. But I can't really say you would have done something wrong. The people standing around were aghast. I said, my dear friend, even you, while denying the fact of evil and denying the face, the responsibility of evil, find it inescapable to run from the feeling of evil. You see what he was saying? He said, I would not be able to say you've done something wrong, but I wouldn't like it. I wouldn't enjoy it. Well, why wouldn't you like it? Why wouldn't you enjoy it? Because you know it's wrong. There is a law upon your heart. God has put this moral sense within you. Paul goes on in verse 15. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. The fact that God's law is written upon our hearts, that a law is written upon our hearts, affects us. It affects our conscience. Now, what is our conscience? Your understanding of the conscience might be affected by Walt Disney and the film Pinocchio with Jiminy Cricket. And you know the song, I won't sing it to you, but always let your conscience be your guide. Now, that's probably not what Paul is referring to here. Always let your conscience be your guide. Maybe Jiminy Cricket has the idea of the conscience as being that moral sense that tells you right from wrong. Now, we've already seen there is a moral sense. There is a law upon the hearts of men and women. So what is the conscience? Well, the conscience, we read this, their conscience bears witness, verse 15, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. And so it seems that the conscience is something reflective. It is a retrospective thing. A conscience is something given to us by which we can evaluate our own actions according to the moral sense that God has given us. God has given us a moral sense, and the conscience enables us to evaluate our actions according to that moral sense. The conscience is a tool that God has given us. I have a spirit level at home. At least I did have one. I went to look for it the other day, and I think I've lent it to someone, and I can't remember who. And as a consequence, two screws went into my wall to hang a picture, and they needed to be level, and I'm not entirely convinced they are. Nobody's made any comment yet, so I think I've got away with it. But a conscience would have told me. A spirit level would have told me. It would have told me if those two things were in line with each other. And the conscience acts like that. It's the tool, the mechanism God has given us whereby we can see how our actions match up to our inner sense of right and wrong. Now, of course, we need to be careful because consciences can be oversensitive. We can come to a conclusion that we did wrong when we didn't do wrong. We can come to a bad conclusion. Paul writes about that in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. So there were Christians in Corinth who were concerned about the meat they were eating because it was sacrificed to idols and all that kind of thing. The point he was making, though, is that you can come to the wrong conclusion. You can be convinced that you've done something wrong and you haven't done anything wrong. Also, the opposite is true. A conscience can become seared. You can think you've done right when in fact you've done wrong. Paul writes this in 1 Timothy 4 verse 2 about people whose consciences are seared. They've evaluated things badly. And perhaps we could suggest many examples of that in our society today, where right is called wrong and wrong is called right. Consciences can become seared. But the point is this, the point Paul is making is this. There are people who do not possess the law of God, and yet they will still be accountable to God because God has put a law upon their hearts, and he has also given them a conscience by which they can evaluate their own actions. Maybe people's consciences were seared in the past. When we think about segregation in the 1950s in the United States, it was the normal pattern of things, and so nobody questioned what they did. Maybe a good example of consciences being seared. But even though a conscience can be seared, and we can evaluate things badly, it remains a mechanism that God has given us by which we can measure ourselves. And the result is verse 15. Look at verse 15. The second part of verse 15. Their conscience bears witness and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. Our conscience points the finger at us. It points the finger at our guilt. Sometimes our conscience might excuse us, but our conscience will also accuse us. And we will know we've done wrong. And then verse 16, on that day when according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. One day those inner conflicts will be revealed. At the moment, I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know how your conscience operates. I don't know what you've done. But a day is coming when our conflicting thoughts will be revealed on the day of judgment. And God will see our actions. And he will see our own conclusions. And our own hearts will condemn us. So if I was in Hebron now, I might say, there we are, another bleak Sunday. None of this sounds very hopeful, does it? But we need to see the bad news before we can understand the wonder of the gospel. My prayer for many people, I don't know you, so I can say this with freedom this evening. I know my own congregation, and I know those who come week by week and are not believers. And they come out of habit, and they've been coming for some time, and some are children, and they hear the gospel regularly, but they are not believers themselves. My prayer is that what is said here might be real to individuals. I heard an illustration from somebody else, which I found helpful a couple of weeks ago, and the illustration was this. Imagine you drove home tonight, and after a few minutes of driving, you look in your rearview mirror and you see a police car behind you. What happens when you see a police car behind you? Your eyes go to your speedometer. How fast am I going? You then start to think, are my brake lights working? Are my rear lights working? What's the tread like on my tires? You start to worry about all kinds of things. Now, you knew the law before that police car was behind you. But suddenly, the law matters. And that's my prayer, that people would have such a sense of God's presence that they would sense that he is there, and therefore they need to be right, and they are not right, and they need to be forgiven. They need to be put right with God. Look at how this little section ends. On that day when according to my gospel, Paul says. This is my gospel. Now, first of all, consider he says gospel. I said this sounds like bad news. But Paul says, this is my gospel. A gospel is good news, a joyful message. How in the world is this a joyful message? Well, the wrath of God and the judgment of God all comes under the heading of gospel. There are many ways in which I could try and cheer you up this evening. We sing hymns. When I was in school, I used to try and get the pupils to join in the singing. When you're a teenager in school, it is not cool to sing, and assemblies can be quite dismal affairs. And so I would stand at the front, and sometimes I take the tactic of telling them off. Unless you sing better, we'll do singing practice at break time. But sometimes I try and take a different approach. And I remember once using this approach, and it didn't work. But I remember saying, research shows that singing is good for you. It cheers you up. And I try to get them to sing in that way. It's why people go to the cinema, and they have the words of the Sound of Music on the bottom of the screen, and people sing along. And there's a new musical out at the moment, The Greatest Showman, and people sing the songs, and singing the songs cheers you up. Now, I could try and cheer you up this evening by singing, and we could have a good sing-song, and we could sing all night. And you could skip off down the high street and think, isn't life wonderful? I feel so good. But it might be this evening that there are all kinds of things that are affecting your mind. And you have a deep depression that you can't shake off. There are all kinds of circumstances. We cheapen the gospel if we give the impression that the Christian faith is just about making you happy. The Christian faith, here as Paul presents it in Romans, is primarily concerned about putting you right with God. And therefore, when you're in the depths of depression, And even the weather in the winter might make you feel low. You can know within an inner joy that you're right with God because your sin is forgiven. Are you right with God? That's what matters. You're guilty. Paul shows you that. But are you right with God? This is Paul's gospel. It's a gospel which includes God's judgment. But it's possible to know that all is right. You are right with God. I mentioned this morning, one of our members died on Thursday morning. And I won't share with you the details of why it was a particularly sad occasion. There were many things that didn't seem right about it. But I think it is possible for the devil to have one last attack on a believer. And she needed assurance that yes, her particular circumstances were particularly sad. Yet all was right with God. That God does all things well. That her sin was forgiven. That nothing could separate her from the love of God in Jesus Christ. And then consider, Paul says, this is my gospel, but it's my gospel, he says. That doesn't mean he's the author of it, he's made it up. Paul said in the very first verse, he describes the gospel as the gospel of God in chapter 1, verse 1. So why does Paul call it my gospel? He says it's my gospel because it's the gospel he believes. It's mine. It's the truth that I know. I know my sin is forgiven. I know that I've been put right with God. And so can you say that this evening? This is my gospel. These truths are precious to me. This is my Saviour. This is my Jesus. What a humbling thing to be able to say. Read the vision. Read those visions in the book of Revelation of Christ. Who he is. He's somebody to be feared. But we can say he is my Jesus because he has come to sinful people like you and me. And he's come and he welcomes sinful people to himself. He never turns any away. What a Saviour we have. Can you say, he is my Saviour? We'll sing.